I'm Dr. Chuck Wallington, author of A Seat at the C-Suite Table, and you're listening to Black Men Sundays.
It's a Black Man Sunday. Time to put all childish things away. I refuse to be the man I was yesterday. Gotta put my best foot forward and elevate.
What's going on, everybody? This is Black Men Sundays. I'm your host, Corey Sylvester Murray, and we're talking about generational wealth, mental health, finance, and business. And before we introduce today's guest, my brother Eric from Huntsville, aka Hunts Vegas, Alabama, alumni of Alabama A&M. Who do you have for our Black Men Sunday spotlight, my brother?
Hey, thanks for that, Corey. Today's spotlight, I'm going to feature a guy by the name of Henry Blair. Now, Henry Blair was a farmer and a free man before the Emancipation Proclamation. He invented two devices to increase agricultural productivity. Now, the first was a corn planter that he invented was in 1834. And the second one was a cotton planter that he did in 1836. Now, his goal was to reduce inefficiencies from manual labor. The Mechanics magazine, published in August 6th of 1836, described it as a saving the labor for of eight men was the effectiveness of this invention that he provided. Now, Blair's discoveries helped farmers grow more food for their masses, not just for their local communities. Now, for Feeding America, farmers are the heart of what we do. A large percentage of the food our neighbors receive at the local food pantry is packaged right here on the farm, where it's grown thanks to the partnership with the USDA. That's my spotlight for today, Mr. Henry Blair, a contributor of the efficiencies of labor for farmers. Now, Corey, back to you.
Thank you, Eric, for that spotlight. I appreciate that, man. I was going to say at the end, see, if you went to the real A&M, you would have said it a little smoother, but you know, I got you, family. We got you. You know, we the real A&M over here.
You the real A&M, fam. Real.
You. Yeah, well, you know, it's Sunday. I'm going to just say fam you, but you know what we say Monday through Saturday, though.
I got you.
Definitely, man. Appreciate you and appreciate that spotlight, my brother. Let's go on and introduce today's guest for sure, man. So we talking about the seat at the C-suite table. You know, a lot of brothers say, I want a seat at the table. A lot of brothers aren't getting that seat these days. So what did I do? I brought on a C-suite executive. Let me run down this brother's accolades real quick. This brother has a PhD in leadership studies from North Carolina A&T State University. My brother Kalali gonna love that. This brother has a master's in communication management from Syracuse. And this brother has an undergrad degree in journalism from the University of North Carolina. You know the school MJ went to, the real UNC. I don't have to do all that. This brother also spent time as a newspaper reporter. That's going to be a vital part of today's conversation. So without further ado, Dr. Chuck Wallington, welcome to Black Men Sundays, brother. How you doing?
Thank you, sir. I'm doing well. How are you doing?
Oh, I couldn't be better. I'm excited to have this conversation with you. We're talking about a seat at the C-suite table. Before we begin, I did leave some things that I kind of wanted to hear your voice before I read the rest of your resume. This brother is a marketing and communications executive vice president. Come on now. This brother also is a chief marketing and communications officer. So when we're talking about a seat at the C-suite, you have to bring a brother on that's actually in the C-suite. So Chuck Wallington, I want to start off because I feel like these days a lot of entrepreneurs, and then with inflation going on, a lot of brothers are saying, I don't feel like higher education is a path I should take because of the debt I'm going to be in, and then I may have trouble finding a job. So before we dive into the book, I just want to get your response about education these days in 2024.
So I think that's an interesting way to frame the conversation. So I will tell you right out of the gate, I have a bias towards education for men of color in 2024 and beyond. I get the fact that you could always argue day in and day out that an education is expensive and you may not get that return on the investment. I would argue that we've got to have credentials. We have to be certified. We have to have something that says that we have accomplished and mastered a certain level of proficiency. Now, for some people, that may mean that they go off and they become a master plumber, Well, guess what? You had to go to school to get that certification to become a master plumber or a master electrician. So I am not downplaying those crafts because they're important as well. But to become a self-supporting man of color, you've got to have some credentials. So I encourage brothers who look like us to say, where am I being led? Where's the good Lord leading me? What do I enjoy doing? And then what type of certification do I need to do that job and to do it very well? So for some, it will mean going on to gain an undergraduate degree and perhaps a master's or a terminal degree. For some, it will simply mean I enjoy doing other things and I want to be certified while doing those other things so that society looks at me and says, this guy knows what he's talking about when he opens his mouth to talk about plumbing or electrical work or healthcare administration work.
Great information. Great information. But, you know, we're here to talk about C-suite, sitting at the C-suite table. A lot of brothers, I want to be a boss. I want to sit at the table. So I said, let me bring one in that looks like us. So before we jump into this book, I also want to ask you, because I feel like a lot of times in the Black community, going back to the education, it's like that degree really can carry you farther than just being the entrepreneur without degree. So I just wanted to make that clear while I have you on here, because I'm seeing too many times online, don't go to college. You're spending your money. You're not going to be able to pay it back. You're going to be in debt. But then at the same time, after reading your book, looking at, you know, the subjects that you had, I said, wow, everybody on there had a minimum of a bachelor's degree. So let's dive into the book, because I'm already hyped up about it. And I read it. So just to let you know, and I'm a journalist, too, from FAMU. So we're about to have a good time. So let's talk about a seat at the C-suite table. You're the author of this book. Let's talk about the impetus of this book, and let's talk about how you selected the participants.
So I'll start with your first question. So what made me write the book? I will tell you, so the topic of this book was the focus of my dissertation research. And I was interested in the journeys of Black men to the C-suite because I am one of those. And I always wondered if my experiences were isolated to me or were there other men out there who had shared the same highs and lows that I had. And so that's what made me do the research. So I did that research as a part of my dissertation study to earn the PhD. Towards the end of the process, Corey, one of the five professors on my dissertation committee said to me, Chuck, you have a book in this research. Let me tell you, my response was, a book? All I want to do is defend and graduate. I'm not thinking about a book or anything else. But her words stayed with me. So I did successfully defend. I graduated, but I could never shake what she said. I kept hearing that in the back of my mind. And so I took about 9 months and just didn't do anything. I needed some time to decompress and to kind of just chill and go back into life, but I could not shake what she was saying. So about 9 months after that, I reached out to her and I said, so this book that you were talking about, I've never written a book. What's that process like? And she says, I will connect you with an editor who's connected to a publisher, and that's how you get started. So the long and the short, Corey, is it was never something I set out to do. But again, the good Lord clearly had this in his plan for me. And so after about a 9 month hiatus where I couldn't shake it, I said, well, if I'm ever going to be comfortable again in life, let me go ahead and do what I believe the good Lord has in store for me. And let me start the process of writing and editing this book. So that's how the book came to be. It was a part of my research, but never something on my short list of things to do.
Great information. And let's advance a little bit to, because I saw you had 30 participants.
Yes.
So, but I did notice just looking at them all, the minimum, they all at a minimum had a bachelor's degree.
Yes.
Because I feel like brothers that say, hey, can I be in the C-suite if I don't have a degree at all? What's your take on that?
So I'm going to say that you certainly, there are exceptions. I am sure there are folks in C-suites out there somewhere who do not have bachelor's degrees. However, if you look at the 30 men that I interviewed, you're right. All had a minimum of a bachelor's degree. Many of them had advanced degrees. A couple even had terminal degrees. So if you aspire for a C-suite level role in a U.S. corporation, particularly one that is controlled by white men, you know, white men and women, you're going to have at least the bachelor's degree to have the ability to at least have a conversation. and to show people what you're able to do. So yes, that would be the minimum education requirement. And to your earlier question about how I identified these 30 men, when I started the process, I knew five or six of them. And so I reached out to them first and foremost and said, this is what I'm doing for my dissertation. Will you allow me to interview you and tell your story? And to a person, they all said yes. Then the methodology I used to identify the other 25 men was I asked them at the end of the interview, do you know of someone who's also a C-suite executive whom I could interview? And many of them did, and they referred me on. Many didn't, and that's okay. But brothers, here's where the women kicked in. So I reached out to men and women in my network and said, here's what I'm doing for my dissertation research. Here's who I'm looking for. Do you know somebody? And so many women that I know said, oh, interview my husband, or I work with somebody, or let me connect you with a colleague. So it was, yes, thanks to the original five or six, but it was also thanks to the men and women in my broader network who connected me with the other 25 men who were willing to share their stories with me. And that's how I got to the 30 that I ended up interviewing.
Great information, great information. And that leads me back to the, you know, you spent time as a newspaper reporter. So let's talk about, and I'm a journalist too. So my journalist friends, my publicist friends, they're going to love this. Matter of fact, this is episode 105 of Black Men Sundays. We've been doing this for a while.
Oh, wow. So the congratulations.
Thank you, sir. Thank you. So the question for you is, how did you utilize your experience as a journalist, as a reporter, in creating your research as far as, you know, recording it, asking questions? Because I saw by reading your book, you use the qualitative research method,
That's right.
You know, we still use that. We don't call it that now. You know, everything is very simplistic these days. But, you know, using that technique and your experience as a newspaper reporter, as a journalist, how were you able to record your research?
So one of the things that you're taught when you're a reporter, at least when I was coming along many years ago, is that you're not a part of the story. Your job is to ask the right questions, to then listen, record what people are telling you, ask follow-up questions until you feel you have a sense of what the fair and balanced story is. And then your job is to go away and write the story, keeping your own opinions out of it, but sharing with your audience and your readers and your viewers what you believe the facts are that shape a story. That's something that I learned very early on. It's a skill that I've taken throughout my entire career, and it's something that I really leaned into when I was doing the research for the dissertation that is now the book. What I did not want to do was to allow my own experiences to taint the data, because to your point about qualitative research, it simply means that words are our data, right? So I didn't want the words that these men share with me to be tainted by anything that I said or did. So my job was to simply ask the questions, to record what they said, and then to thank them for their time. And that's what I did. So, but here's the other part of this. As soon as the recording was over, sometimes it was all I could do to say, hey, I can relate to what you just said. Or as the recording was ending, they would say, you know what? Well, what was your experience like? And then we would have almost a brother-to-brother conversation, but none of that information fed into the data, right? Because the recording was done, my notes were clean, we were just having a conversation. So I had a connection with the vast majority of these brothers, but that connection did not start until we had finished the interview. So the words that they gave me were the unfiltered words they gave me without me having to say anything about my own experiences.
Oh, that's great information, because I was going to ask you that next. Like, did you have like a pre-interview where you kind of discussed you and how did that affect the research? But I'm glad you answered that for me already. So we don't even have to go there again. That's wow. That's awesome. That's awesome. But let's go back to the C-suite, because I feel like a lot of brothers these days, you know, brothers are educated. Brothers have multiple degrees. Mm-hmm. We're not quite as cool as the sisters yet. You know, the sisters is killing us with the masters and the PhDs. You could ask my man Kalali Dogby on the line. He has a master's in public policy. So you could ask him, but, you know, that's my brother on the line. You know, it's Black Men Sundays. We keep it real on here. But my question for you is for brothers that say, you know, I'm about to graduate college. At some point, I do want to be able to acquire a C-suite position. So what advice would you give for brothers where they're a senior in college, their grades are good, they have internships, They're about to jump out into the real world, but they have C-suite ambitions. What tips and advice, what do's and don'ts can you give to be able to sit in that C-suite?
So the first thing I would say to someone who is graduating college or young in his career would be, keep that goal of the C-suite in mind, but do not let it consume you. Your job right now is to master that which is in front of you. So if you're in an entry-level role, or if you're a mid-level manager, or you're a director level or whatever, your job when you get up and go to work every day, or when you log in remotely, is to make sure that you have mastered everything that's related to your current role. You have to be first and foremost known as that subject matter expert in whatever field you were hired into. So if you're an accountant and you one day want to be a chief financial officer, you stay focused right now on mastering all things accounting. If you want to be a public relations officer later in life, that's great, but master everything now related to writing news releases and writing talking points and setting up events, all the things that we do on an ongoing basis. Master those things first, because you're going to need those skills later on as you are climbing the ladder and as you are becoming more proficient in what you want to do. So that would be my first piece of advice. My second piece of advice would be, at the same time that you're mastering those tactical skills, Corey, make sure that you're also aware of and are developing your leadership style and your leadership brand. The two have to go hand in hand. They have to go hand in hand. So when I say leadership style and brand, what do I mean? You want to be the type of person that people want to work with. You want to be the type of person that people want to serve on committees with. You want to be the type of person that people say, I enjoy working with Corey. I enjoy our time together. He's easy to get along with. We build off of each other, and we can put together a plan and we get things done. That he inspires me, right? He gets the big picture, and we can work on strategy and tactics at the same time. That's what you want people to think about you, because those skills are necessary for folks who are going to be, again, elevated to higher levels of responsibility. You have to not only have mastered your day job, as I like to call it, but you've got to be able to lead and inspire people. You got to see the big picture. You got to understand the strategy of the business that you're in. Why does this business exist to begin with? And what then is your role in supporting the growth and success of that business? How are you going to inspire people who work with you or who don't work with you that you can influence to also rally around the cause and get work done? That's what it takes to get to the C-suite. You have to have mastered, first of all, your day job. You got to have a great leadership style and brand. And then you have to have people who are cheering you on. Those are your allies and your sponsors, the people who are going to speak favorably of you and about you when you're not in the room. When people are discussing promotions, where people are discussing people taking on broader roles, you've got to have allies and sponsors in the room who will advocate on your behalf. So you have to have a convergence of all those things, if you will. You have to have mastered your day job and be really good at that. You've got to have a really solid leadership style and brand that works for you. And then you have to have people advocating for you when those opportunities come around.
Great information. That leads to my next question, because, you know, as I was reading your book, it was like through the 30 participants, I felt like, oh, this is what the C-suite is like. So for me, the undercurrent, or as they call the elephant in the room, to me feels like, okay, you in the C-suite, but you still working two jobs. You're still a Black man, might be the only one in there. Mm-hmm. And then, like, I like the reference you had where the guy was on the plane and he was the boss, and you know, everyone else worked under him, but the servicemen, even from the airline, I almost said stewardess, I'm old school, but the flight attendants treated him like he was the, almost right. Like he was not the boss.
That's
so,
right.
So one thing that, and that's one thing I noticed in the book, I was like, man, you in the C-suite and it's still like this up here? So break that down, because I feel like for me, that blew me away, you know?
Right. You know, so getting to the C-suite and being blessed to get there is one thing. Being able to stay there is another, and dealing with the challenges that are innate in being in the C-suite as a man of color are also something else you have to contend with. So it doesn't just stop once you get there, right? If anything, the challenges intensify because you're a man of color. We'll talk about men for a second, because you're a man of color. So you walk into the room, you're now the only man of color, perhaps, sitting around the table, and there's that dynamic. You have to navigate that, you know, and just imagine. And that can be a bit daunting, but you've got to be able to navigate that dynamic in and of itself. You know, some of the men talked about, you know, their physiques, right? So, you know, some of them said, you know, but I am tall and I weigh this amount of weight and I'm dark skinned. And they said, and I acknowledge that the way the good Lord created me can be intimidating to other people. And so they talk about having to navigate the way that God created them just to maintain that C-suite table and remain good at what they are doing. So, yes, unfortunately, those challenges and barriers, Corey, don't stop simply because you make it to the C-suite. Those who succeeded have figured out how to be successful in spite of those dynamics that exist once you get there.
And also another thing that I took from just the reading, I mean, I'm not going to lie, I read your book literally in one read. My wife was like, man, you're still in the office? I'm like, I can't stop reading. It's a great read, and I just got sucked into it, you know. So, you know, my next question for you, well, I saw a number in there that kind of bothered me. It's in your book. I'm quoting your book, okay. Attribution. It says white men hold 95.5% of board chair positions versus 3.9% of African-American men behind African-American women.
Yes.
Let's talk about that.
Yes. Again, if you think about the structures of U.S. corporations, and we talk about that early on in the book, think about U.S. corporations who were founded by white men for the success of white men, right? And so when these businesses were started years and years and years and years ago, white men employed other white men. So they set up an organizational structure that worked for them. What they never really anticipated was women coming into the workforce, and they didn't anticipate, you know, men and women of color, right, being in the workplace. So this structure that they set up for themselves works for them. Enter other people who are now changing the dynamics and the culture, or at least attempting to, and there's resistance, right? There's just resistance to that happening. And so that's where you find the challenges. That's where you find the challenges. And again, fast forward to today, you're correct. Those numbers are sadly low, because in order for those numbers to increase, someone would have to step aside and give up something. The data would suggest that, you know, African-Americans are roughly 14 point, whatever it is, percent of the entire U.S. Populations. And so if you just do the quick math, there should be many more African-Americans, you know, sitting on boards of directors of companies, sitting as CEOs of companies, being on the executive team or in the C-suite of organizations. And that's just not the case. There's just not the case. And so that's why there's the still remaining struggle to increase the number of Black men and, frankly, Black women in these C-suite roles. But it starts at the top. It has to start with an organization's board saying, look, we ourselves want to be diverse and we want to reflect the community around us that we serve. And we want the executive team of the company that we work on to be diverse and to reflect the community that we serve. And then we want everybody else to reflect that diversity. That's a process, my brother Corey, that happens over time. And it happens if a company is intentional about it happening. It will not just happen by osmosis.
Gotcha. Yeah, because I noticed in the book, those 30 participants were between the ages of like 43 and I think like 75.
Yes.
70 plus.
Yeah, early 70s. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. So does that imply that to get in a C-suite role, am I guess, better positioned if I'm in my 40s going forward? Like, let's say I'm already working a job and I want to be recognized and I'm advancing. So are you saying basically that, you know, you have a higher chance of getting in the C-suite with the more experience that you have on the job? And that's why the age range was 43 to 75?
Well, remember, these men work for a variety of companies, right? So, you know, they were from what, 12 different companies or 18 different companies, you know, 12 different states, including the District of Columbia. So they were scattered around the U.S. The size of the company varied. You know, some worked for Fortune companies, some were leaders at nonprofits and everything in between. So I think the answer is it has less to do with your age and more to do with the size of the company that you work for, where that company is located, the business the company's in, and so on and so on. I work in healthcare. I was in my 50s, right? I was in my 50s when I was invited into the C-suite. So again, back to what I said earlier on, if your goal is to eventually be a C-suite leader, keep that as a goal. Don't lose sight of that goal and don't become distracted also by the fact that, well, gee, now I'm 35 and I'm not there, or gee, now I'm 45 and I'm not there. Stay focused. And if it's in it for the good Lord has it in it for you to do it, it will happen. I assure you that it will happen.
Well, that's great information. And I'll ask you one more question and then I'll let my brother speak because, you know, they call me Corey Iverson. Yeah, I went to Bethel High in Virginia, Allen Iverson also.
Yes,
sir. So my final question before I open the mic, because I could talk to you for like hours. But my question for you is, you know, as I was reading the book, I was a little discouraged in certain parts about the C-suite. Like, okay, I'm the only brother here, but I might want to grow a beard. I might want to wear my hat like this in there. You know, I saw one guy said it made it easier for him when he was likable around other races.
Mm-hmm.
So when we're talking about the C-suite and Black Men's Studies, we talk about generational wealth, mental mm-hmm. health as well. I feel like that mental health part is real in the C-suite. Let's talk about that a little bit.
Sure. The mental health part of it is real. And, you know, I'm going to back you out of the C-suite for a second. The advice that I have given myself and the advice that I would give others is you have to first be authentically who the good Lord created you to be, right? You got to walk in that and be okay. At the same time, the good Lord gives us a brain to think and to make decisions. So when I decided that I was going to grow facial hair and a beard, I decided that it was okay. Right. I knew I was going to always keep it neat. It was not going to be a distraction. And I decided that it was OK to do that. And so I did. And I still do. And it has not kept me out of the C-suite. Right. So there's that piece about the facial hair. Now, I enjoy a baseball cap and a hoodie with the best of them. And I also enjoy the role that I have, you know, in the C-suite, right? And I recognize that for the culture of the company where I work, it is not in my best interest to put on a baseball cap and a hoodie and make that my normal everyday attire. That will not work for me. That will be a distraction. And so I choose to not do that, right? I just choose to not do that. And in making that decision, I don't feel like I am setting aside anything about myself. I don't feel like I'm putting it on the back burner. I'm simply making a smart decision that says, what do you gain by going in and being a distraction, right? Go in, lean into another part of yourself, which is, you know what? I love a bow tie, right? Let me put on a bow tie and go in and let's sit around the table and let's get the work of the organization done. That's where we as men of color and brothers have to really get ourselves to, right? We got to understand the culture of the organization we're going into. And we got to ask ourselves, does that culture work for me? And if the answer is yes, then great. That's probably a place for you to be. And if that culture works for you, then what about yourself is already authentic and genuine to that culture? And what about yourself is something you should probably wait and, you know, do that in your own free time. So that's how I would answer that question. I think you got to be aware of that culture. You got to still be authentic to yourself, but use your brain and decide when you need to have on, again, in my example, the hoodie and the baseball cap, or when you need to just put on a bow and keep it moving.
Yes. And let's talk about the mental health side of that, because, you know, in some of the research that I read in your book, it was almost like, you know, you kind of need a mental health specialist to kind of, you know, it's a little challenging up there. It's not as sweet as I thought it was.
Well, you know, the guys talked about how they survived, right? And again, I don't want to paint a picture that everybody's story was doom and gloom, because it was not. And again, these men were very candid about what it has taken them through their lives and their careers to be successful. And they acknowledge as a group that, you know, their faith, their friendship, their families, and for those who are Greek, their fraternities have been really, really fundamental in providing that support, right? So these are the groups and these are the people who love us regardless. These are the people who take the good, the bad, and the ugly of us, and they love us and they nurture us, and they give us a safe space to come into. And so again, almost to a person, the gentleman that I interviewed talked about, you know, needing to rely into their faith, you know, and appreciating their faith for those who were active in that space, and appreciating the other outlets and ways that they could practice that mental well-being and keeping themselves fresh. I didn't ask any of them specifically if they are doing therapy or anything like that. Maybe they are. If they are, good for them, right? If that's what works for them and they need therapy, there's absolutely nothing wrong with that at all.
All right, great information. All right, fellas, the stage is open. Say your name and the city or state you're representing. Let's go.
All right, well, I'll go ahead and ask some questions. This is Kalali Dogbe. I'm calling out of Calvert County, Maryland. Great.
How you doing, Kalali?
All right, how are you doing?
I'm well, sir.
That is good. I'm glad to hear it. I'm glad. First and foremost, thank you so much for spending some time with us on Black Men Sunday. Definitely appreciate it.
You're welcome.
I'm excited to have you on the show, just because when you started off, the first thing you started off, Corey asked you a question about education, and you say, you know, you got to admit your bias, you know, for higher education. I'm the same way. I'm probably the one on the show that talks about, you know, higher education the most and how we need to encourage people to do higher education. Mm-hmm. Just because there is a trend now for people to say, hey, you know, go get a trade, or you don't need college education. And there's nothing wrong with doing that if that's for you. But, you know, I've always been an advocate for higher education. Just want to throw a little fact out there that I Googled while we were doing this. College educated workers enjoy a median earnings advantage of $36,000 or 84%, $36,000 a year, or 84% higher than those whose highest degree is a high school diploma. So just wanted to, you know, put that out there.
Thank you for the facts. They speak for themselves.
Exactly. If that's what we talk about. Right? So, you know, just going into that, one of the things that, you know, I think that we get out of a higher education is like the ability to build a bigger network. So I wanted to know from you, first of all, what is networking to you? Because I know that that's one of the topics that's probably prevalent in your book, although I haven't read it yet. Just read some summaries about it. But what does networking mean to you? And how has networking, let's say, or how does networking benefit people trying to move up into the C-suite?
So networking for me is having that group of people who know about me, know what I'm interested in, know what I have the ability to do that perhaps I haven't thought about, and can make connections with me and for me. I'll give you a couple of examples. So, you know, Corey said that I started my career as a newspaper reporter. So I did that very, very briefly before leaving newspapers and going into doing corporate public relations work. But here's how I got my start. Prior to starting my first job out of undergraduate school as a reporter, I sent my resume to a woman whom I'd never met back here in North Carolina, who was heading corporate public relations for a company here in town or in the area. And I just sent her my resume and said, hey, you know, I've always listened to you. I think you're great. Here's my resume. I'm about to go off and start my career as a reporter, but please stay in touch. I never heard from her. But here's what she did. She knew the recruiter who was searching for an entry-level communications professional to come to North Carolina and work for a Fortune company based in Winston-Salem, which is 30 minutes from my hometown of Greensboro. And so she sent the recruiter my resume. Now, mind you, she and I've never met. The recruiter calls me and says, I have a copy of your resume. We're recruiting for an entry-level public relations professional. I would love for you to come back to North Carolina and interview for this role. I said, okay. Thinking, okay, well, I probably will never get the job. At the very least, I'll get a free trip back to North Carolina. I'll see my family, have some good food, and I'll go on back to, I was in Dallas at the time. I'll go on back to Dallas. And so I did that. Well, the interview went well. They invited me back a second time. And at the end of the second interview, before I could get on the plane to go back to Dallas, the recruiter was calling my parents' house and trying to reach me because they were wanting to make a job offer. That's networking. Right? All I did was send my resume to someone I never met. Mm. And she then passed it on to somebody else, and the rest is history. So that's just one example of networking. I will also tell you that as I was leaving my role at RJR, again, someone else whom I had worked with in the marketplace as a professional said, hey, American Express is recruiting for someone at a director level. I think you'd be great for the role. He made the connection, and the rest is history. So again, you know, networking really does work, right? And you may not see the benefits of networking right now, but trust and believe, if you do have that network of people and if they're committed to you and your success, then when it's time for the doors to open for you, they'll open. They absolutely will open. So I encourage people to create a network and to work the network and let people know what you want to do. If you don't tell people what you want to do, they'll have no idea, right? They'll be guessing. And you don't want that. So be clear with people what you want to do. And frankly, be clear with people about what you don't want to do so you don't waste their time thinking about things for you when that's not really what you believe you're supposed to do.
Well, I appreciate that. That's definitely a gem. Like, because, you know, in our community, sometimes we stay closed mouths. You know, we don't want to talk about what we want to do. And mm-hmm. then people don't know what we want to do. So then that closes off potential opportunities for us. So, you know,
that's
so
right. We feel like we've got to solve it ourselves. And let me just tell you, you know what? Our white brothers and sisters don't operate that way, right? They're taught from the very beginning to look out for each other and to work with each other. And they do. Mm. They do that. And so we as brothers have got to figure that out. We've got to put our pride aside. We've got to be able to say to people, look, this is what I want to do. Mm. Can you help me? Or do you know someone who can help me out? That's how we're going to be successful, if willing to work with each other.
Mm, that's big. That's big. That's really big. So let me ask you this, because I noticed even in your example there, you said you had a female colleague or a female friend you were able to send a resume off to. We were talking about how women are even ahead of, I think it's women of color, even ahead of men of color in the C-suite. Do you think that women just network better than men?
Perhaps it's that. But again, go back to what I said about the history of U.S. corporations. So again, data would suggest that white men are more comfortable around black women than they are black men.
Yeah, I heard that. Yeah.
Right? Because if they're the ones who are making the hiring decisions, they're going to hire people, generally speaking, and again, the data supports this, hire people first and foremost who look like them. And then if they're going to hire folks who don't look like them, they're going to give the nod because they're more comfortable with a black woman than they are with a black man. So that's a reality that we have to deal with. And again, we can't let that reality keep us down, but we have to be aware that that's the reality. And that's why, you know, we have to be, as they say, twice as good, right? You know, just to get into the door and have the conversation.
Yeah, that's interesting. So that's one way, I guess, that the constructs that were created by white men historically sometimes present obstacles for black men trying to break into the C-suite. Can you think of like any other obstacles, or were there any other obstacles you'd like to highlight from your book that were also talked about?
Well, the men were very honest about the impact of race and racism, right? Okay. They talked very clearly and very openly about the fact that, you know, before they even opened their mouths, someone's made an assessment about them based on their race, based on their skin color, based on how the good Lord created them. And so you have to work through that before you ever open your mouth and say, hello, you know, my name is Chuck Wallington and I'm very happy to meet you. Someone's already made that assessment about me and about all of us who are on the call today. So there's that dynamic, right? So the men talked very openly about that. They talked also about, you know, racism again, and having to, it ranges from having to make themselves, the people around them have to be more comfortable around them than perhaps around others. And they talked about doing that. One guy said, I can remember being sick as a dog, he described it, on a Friday or a Monday, and, you know, didn't feel like going to work. He says, but I got up and I went to work because I didn't want people to think that the black guy is calling in sick on Friday or Monday. Well, you know what? That's a dynamic that probably all of us have struggled with at some point in our lives. So that's a concession that we make because we're men of color. We don't want people to think any differently about us. So there are lots of examples in the book, and there are lots of examples in the literature out there about how, yeah, as a Black man, there are challenges and there are barriers for us. And again, you know, the end of the story is there is a way, right? We don't have to become hamstrung because of those challenges and barriers. We have to be smart and savvy and be willing to work around those. And again, we have to have people working with us. I tell folks all the time, it's one thing for us to be prepared. It's another altogether for somebody who can open the door and give us the opportunity to come in. The two have to go hand in hand. We can be just as prepared if we want to, but if no one ever opens that door and says, you know, tag, you're it, it's your time, then we will struggle. The numbers will remain low.
Yeah. No, that really hit home for me because I know that even in my career, you know, oftentimes I'll make sacrifices like that. Like even now, you know, you got like, you might have like doctor's visits you got to do or something like that. And you're like, man, I don't want to call in sick right now. Or I want to stay off right now because, you know, I don't want the perception to be that I'm, you know, slack or calling out of work. Or not available when I need to be available. So I know even in my career, I even struggle with that. Mm-hmm. I just want to switch gears real quick, and then I'll let you go. I definitely appreciate your time. I heard you said that you were that you were also a journalist. You started out as a journalist.
Yes.
So just like in the media, do you feel like portrayals of Black people, whether negative or positive, have an impact on the wealth accumulation opportunities of Black people?
I would say so. And again, I've not done any research specifically on that, but I think you could probably extract that. So there's the perception. And so the perceptions can slow us down, right? They limit our opportunities. They limit what people are willing to allow us to show what we can do. And so I would say, yes. Yeah, there's certainly probably a correlation between the two. And again, our job is to then say, all right, but let me not. So that's that piece of data. Let me show you what I can do, right? Let me show you what I can do, and let's get in there and do the absolute best that we can.
For sure. Definitely appreciate you. Let me pick your brain for a little bit. I'm gonna definitely make it a point to go out and get your book. What was the name of that book again?
It is called A Seat at the C-Suite Table, and you can find it on Amazon.
Got it. All right. Appreciate you. Definitely. Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Great information so far. So let's talk about mentoring, because one thing in your book that I noticed, and first off, I like to say Black Men Sundays, I'm a mentor in my community. I'm an amazing shake competition judge. So like the top five kids at those schools come to me, you know, it's a meet and greet, firm handshake, looking in the eye kind of thing. So, but let's talk about the importance of mentors, because my question is for brothers that are, you know, want to be in the C-suite, that going back to that college kid, how important is it to have a mentor already in the C-suite, or is it just as important to have a mentor just in that field?
Yes and yes. So to the extent that you can find a mentor who is in your field, that's great. To the extent you can find a mentor is simply, you know, good at what he's doing, he or she's doing, and can support you for an indefinite period of time, then you'll be great. Let me talk for a second about the difference between mentors, coaches, role models, allies, because we sometimes blur them all together and they have very unique roles. And there's some overlap, but there's some uniqueness as well. You know, generally speaking, a mentor is that person who is committed to you and your success for the long haul. There isn't really a beginning, a middle, or an end necessarily, but they're committed to you and your career and your life for an indefinite period of time. The mentor may or may not be someone who is in your chosen field, but the value the mentor brings is he or she likely has had whatever those experiences that you're going through. They've likely already had those experiences and are on the other side. So part of the value of that relationship is they can share their own experiences as they are helping you, you know, make decisions about what's going on in your life right now. So that's a mentor, generally speaking. Then there's also the coach. So the coach is someone who is going to give you that opinion and point of view on some very unique and subtle things. So maybe it's someone who coaches you on how you dress, right, for the business world, or how you speak. Who, they may also coach you on, you're about to go into this particular setting. Maybe you've never gone to a, you know, board of trustees meeting before. This is what you can expect. This is what you should do while you're there. Or you're going to a business dinner for the very first time. Here's what to expect. So that's what that coach can do for you as well. Role models, again, are typically folks who, or oftentimes folks who have done or are doing what you've done, so they can show you what it's like to be a businessman or a doctor or a plumber or an electrician, whatever it is your chosen field. You get to learn from them because they've already mastered that and they're doing really, really well. Allies and sponsors are the folks who are in the room when you're not and they're saying great things about you. So you need an ally and a sponsor in whatever your company you're working for in order to be promoted. Right? In order to be given the lateral move assignments, to be given people who are reporting into you, you got to have a sponsor and an ally in the room who's willing to have that conversation and speak up on your behalf. When they're doing that, they're putting their own name and their own brand on the line and they're vouching for you. So that's generally speaking kind of the distinction between all of them. Now, you know, the value of mentors. If you read the book, about half the guys in the book had mentors and they raved about their experiences with mentors and how much they appreciated having mentors. The other half who didn't have mentors also raved about mentors and talked about how they wished they had mentors themselves and they were successful even without mentors. So, you know, the bottom line here is you can be successful without a mentor. Right? It's going to be a little more challenging and you're going to have to do a little bit more work, but you can succeed without a mentor. You will not succeed without an ally and a sponsor. Unless you own the company or unless your mom and dad own the company, you are not going to succeed without an ally and a sponsor. You've got to have other people in the room who are cheering you on and are saying now is the time for Corey to take on this role. So again, want to just kind of level set there and kind of set some parameters out there. So quickly for my own story. So I've had one, maybe two mentors in the course of my entire career. One of my best mentors sadly died of a heart attack when he was young and I was young as well. And I was never able to really find someone to replace him. So I've not really had a mentor, and God has blessed me. God has still put other people in my pathway to show me what it's like to be, or who've been role models, who've been coaches, and clearly I've had allies and sponsors in order to be blessed to get to where I am now. So I'm an example of how you can be successful without having a mentor, but you absolutely have to have the others in order to be successful. So, you know, for folks, it just may vary, but I would suggest, again, back to your original question, I would suggest that to the extent that you can make a connection with someone and find someone to be a mentor, that would be great. The mentor doesn't have to look like you either. The mentor can be a female if you're a male, and the mentor can be white or any other persuasion. All you care about is they're committed to you and your success, and you can learn from them based on their experiences.
Man, you a gem dropper, man. And I have three more questions for you, then I'll let you go. So, but my next question for you is, when we're talking about mentoring, so if I sent you an email and I said, Dr. Wallington, I want you to mentor me, because we've had other C-suite brothers, you know, that's why I love Black Men Sundays. Like, this is episode 106. I can name about six brothers in the C-suite. Well, seven, including you now. You know, you're a part of the family now, but one brother said, listen, if you sent me an email and it's not up to par, I might just ignore it. So if I said, Dr. Wallington, this is Corey from Black Men Sundays, I would like for you to mentor me. What do I need to put in the email to really, for you to take me seriously and to take me on as a mentee?
You'd have to also say, this is what I'd like to get out of the mentorship. Here's what I'm bringing to the conversation. Here's how I believe we can best use the time that we have. And then I'm good. I enjoy mentoring. I mentor and I coach people. Some people I've never met face to face, and I don't have to meet them face to face. That's the beauty of technology now. I don't have to meet them face to face. But there are some people that I have that I mentor on a regular cadence. There are some who simply reach out and they'll say, hey, Chuck, do you have 30 minutes or 15 minutes? Sure. get on my calendar and let's have the conversation. I do that. Let me tell you, gentlemen, that's the least that I can do. That's the least that I can do. I am a firm believer. And again, this is before we even get to the C-suite. I'm a firm believer that all of us have to be willing to reach out and help each other. Right? We got to help each other as we are peers right now. We got to bring along that next generation and we've got to be an example for them. We absolutely have to do those things. And it takes time and it takes a commitment. But we're not asking people to marry us. You know, these people coming to us for mentoring aren't asking us to marry them. They're asking for some advice. And it's lonely out there. It's lonely. So the least I can do is offer someone my time to have a conversation. But I tell people at the very beginning, you get to drive this, right? You reached out to me. You've got to tell me what you believe I can do to support you. And I've also got a bunch of questions. So when I get into these conversations with people, I'm not dispensing advice necessarily. I'm asking questions. I want to know, what are you trying to do? What are you trying to solve for in life and in your career? What have you done that you've been successful in? What's been a failure and how have you learned from that failure? So, you know, a lot of people leave interactions with me and they probably think, oh, wow, that was a little more than I bargained for. Well, perhaps, but, you know, that's what true mentoring is really all about. We're supposed to leave those conversations a little bit better than we were when we walked in, you know, to the proverbial room and started the conversation. So yes, I am a huge fan of being, you know, that mentor or that coach. And I do it and I enjoy doing it. And if you read the men in the book, you know, almost to a person, they all said the same thing, right? They are doing their doggonest to give back to people and to bring along that next generation.
Definitely. Definitely. And two more questions. This is the easy one for you. Are you enjoying yourself on Black Men Sundays?
I'm having a blast on this show. I'm having a great time. I appreciate you inviting me.
Definitely, definitely. And let's jump back in because, you know, we're talking about generational wealth. But, you know, that 95.5, 3.9, how do we close the gap? Because in your book, one thing you said closing the gap is a team sport. I said, dang, that's interesting. But at the same token, I saw some of the solutions for closing the gap had a lot of DEI in it. I'm in Florida. DEI is drying up real quick here. So what are your thoughts on that? And how do we close the gap and make it a team sport with DEI drying up?
I had a conversation back in February with some public relations professionals, and we talked about specifically the lack of Black men in the public relations profession. Again, topic that's very close to me as a professional. And what I said to them was, I gave them the data and I said, so why should you care? We talked about it. There were five of us on a panel. We talked about why you should care. And the same thing applies in terms of closing the gap here, right? It is truly a team sport. There are a number of conversations that are happening across the U.S. about this topic and others that are equally as important. And as long as we're talking to ourselves, we're only talking to ourselves. The real movement will occur when people who don't look like us but own the businesses and run the businesses will understand the value of having a diverse pool of people, not only sitting around the C-suite table, but doing everything else in your organization. Once those organizations understand and appreciate that value, they will then say, we get to be a part of the solution, right? And that solution then will be owned by an organization's board, right? That governing body, they will say, this is what we stand for. They'll ensure that they've got a diverse executive team. They'll ensure that the team below them is diverse and so on and so on and so on. But Corey, it happens over time. It does not happen overnight. It happens over time. And it happens in spite of what's going on in the world around us, right? That's going to be the distinction, because you're absolutely right. If you watch what's going on around us, there is a concerted effort, right, to take us back, right, and to pull back the hands of time. And companies can either go along with that or they can say, nope, that's not who we are. Our values would suggest that we're doing other things and we're going to hold steadfast and we're going to do those other things. But it happens one organization at a time, one commitment at a time, and the commitment has to be for the long haul.
And my final question for you, the next generation. Brothers want to be in the C-suite. I'm in school. I kind of asked you about the college, but I'm saying if I'm a kid and I'm like, you know, I want to be in the C-suite. I'm a young black girl. I want to be in the C-suite. What advice would you give at a young age for our next generation to just be prepared?
To follow your dream. If you believe that you want to be in, you want to do a business for a career, follow your dream. Ask your mom and dad to connect, or your auntie or your grandma to connect you with somebody who's doing what you want to do right now. And it doesn't have to be an exact match, but find somebody who works in a US corporation and ask them, can I spend 30 minutes with you? Will you tell me what you do? Tell me how you prepare to do what you do. Tell me what a day is like in your life. Can I come and spend some time with you, right? As I get older or whenever time permits, ask those questions. So if you're young and you believe that you want to be a business executive, hold on to that dream, but do everything that you can now to understand what's really going on there so you can make an informed decision. Again, the data would suggest that one of the reasons that we struggle in business is because when we were growing up, we didn't necessarily see people who work as business executives, right? And if we did, they didn't talk about what they did. So there's that gap. And I'm telling you, our white counterparts are not doing that, right? They're doing exactly what I just said. If their child, before their child says, I want to be a doctor, or I want to be a business executive, or I want to do whatever, parents are making those connections and they're saying, look, here's so and so and we golf together, or here's so and so and we work out at the gym together. I'm going to make a connection so that you can spend some time with him or her. They're doing that. If our counterparts are doing it, why can't we start doing it? So that would be the one thing that I would say. I will also continue to give credit to the Divine Nine and other organizations out there. There's mentoring that's going on, and I encourage and applaud that which is going on. And again, we can continue to do more of it. So I think every organization out there that cares about people of color should say, how do we figure out how to make connections for our young people while they're young and impressionable, so that when they get to high school, they're good and focused. When they get to college, they're taking the right courses at the right times so that they're ready for internships right after their freshman and sophomore and junior years, and so that they're prepared, right, to either graduate, go into the workforce, or graduate and go into graduate school if that's what they want to do, or something in between. So that's what I would say. It's, there's not one particular answer, but there are lots of things that need to happen simultaneously. But it does start with our young children acknowledging the dreams they have and holding fast to those dreams and doing all that they can to learn about what those dreams are when they become realities, the good, the bad, and the ugly.
Wow, great information. And again, where can we get this book?
A seat at the C-suite table. You can get that on Amazon. Just go online to Amazon and type in my name or type in the title, and it will pop up. And in about 2 days, you will have a copy at your home.
Well, that's great, man. Great information. I enjoyed having you on, Dr. Chuck Wallington. I think this is the first time I don't had a Tar Heel, an Orange, and an Aggie all in one person on
Yes,
Black Men
sir.
Sundays, brother.
Thank you. I appreciate the
Definitely.
invite. I've enjoyed my time with you all.
Definitely, brother, and enjoy the rest of your day and enjoy the rest of your week.
Thank you, and you all too. It's a Black Man Sunday.